session number 9253, reel 28.
Mr. Jack Dorgan, reel 28. You've mentioned the fact that the Nottinghamshire miners and other miners went back after only a week. Was there any bitterness in Northumberland and Ashington in particular about this?
Oh yes, quite a lot. Northumberland and Durham, who went through the 1926 strike to the very end, and Nottinghamshire as one of the counties which went back to work with the rest of the other unions in the country at the end of the first week. We Northumberland and Durham, and I believe miners in Kent and miners in Somerset or somewhere, they stayed out many, many months. But we in the Northumberland Durham stayed out to the very bitter end. When I say bitter end, I mean bitter end, because as I've described already, we suffered a tremendous lot in that strike. And at the back of our thoughts always were the fact that Spencer's Union in Nottinghamshire, Spencer's Union, might I say, is the breakaway union from the National Union of Mine Workers. They, of course, were in the coal fields of Nottingham, are in a very better, have always been in a very better position than the rest of the country. Take, for instance, the county of Durham. The coal seam there is 3 foot high to 3 foot three in height. In Northumberland, the coal seam is from 3 foot to 4 foot on an average coal seam height. But here in Nottinghamshire, the coal seam at that time went up to 9 feet in height, which meant that we always considered, whether it was true, correct or not, I don't know, but we always considered that working, we had more height to work in, like the Nottinghamshire miners, was very favourable to them as compared to the Durham miners and the Northumberland miners working in 3 foot seams.
How did this bitterness against the Nottingham miners show itself? Was it just in conversation or...?
Well, no. How could we? Because we in Northumberland were in Northumberland.
No, I mean amongst yourselves.
Yes. But we couldn't... I mean, we never came in contact with any Nottinghamshire miners. But in Northumberland, it was a... Whenever any mention of the coal fields outside of Northumberland and Durham, at once the Northumberland miners' mind stretched out into the fact that you were let down. You were let down by the Nottinghamshire miners. They only thought of themselves and been in a better working conditions and so on, and better able to earn better money. And we always thought of Nottingham miners as the highest paid miners in the country, because their conditions were much better than any other coal mine in the country. And there was always a bitterness in the minds of Northumberland and Durham miners against, and I still have it today, and I'm living here in Nottinghamshire, but I'm always very, very careful when I'm talking to any old people, and I meet quite a lot of old people nowadays, and I'm old myself, I'm always very careful not to get into any quarrel, because I could easily get into a quarrel, because the back of my mind is a contempt for the Nottinghamshire miners. And that is shared by all those who can remember those days in Durham, in the coalfields of Durham, in the coalfields of Northumberland.
Was the strike what they call now solid in the Ashington area? Was there any
question
of scabs or blacklegs?
No, no blacklegs. Not in the 1926 strike. No, no. In one of the strikes that we had, forget now whether it was a 13-week strike. We had a strike for 13 weeks.
I'll come to that then. Was that later, the 13-week strike?
I forget now. I can't place it either before or after. But you asked the question, did we have any strike breakers?
Not in 1926.
Well, it was after the war, of course. After the war, many years after the war.
Did the police or the army get involved in your area?
No, no. Northumberland and Durham miners never had any trouble with the army. There was talk that the government of the day had put some troops into County Durham, into one of the collieries. But what happened there, I never knew very much about it. Because, as I said, we went away into camp and we lived during the whole of that strike away in the country, cut off from the rest of the world, as you might say.
Now, you mentioned that while you were living in the country, it was a coal owner whose land you were living on. Was he aware that you were miners?
Oh, yes, rather. So the gamekeepers, yes.
So there was.
I never met the coal owner. He was a coal owner of some of the collieries in Durham, in the county of Durham. But I met the gamekeeper many times, and also the men. And the gamekeeper told me that he hadn't to disturb us. He had orders from his boss to give us any help within reason. They had to help.
So relationships weren't too bad with the coal owners?
He wasn't, no.
What about the Ashington Colliery Company? How did...
Well, the Ashington... No, Ashington Colliery coal owners... I was always... All the time I was in that 33 years and working down the coal mine, there was always a good relationship between the coal owners and the work people. Now, the managing director of Ashington Collieries, and they arranged 7 different collieries spread out in an area of about 8 or 10 miles up in Northumberland, North Northumberland. The managing director was Mr. Ridley Warham. I met Mrs. Ridley Warham many, many times through my scouting. And I met Ridley Warham as well, but I met her most of all because she interested herself in the doings. Didn't live in Ashington, of course. I don't know where they lived. But she would come into Ashington and would perhaps open a bazaar for someone or do some good deed similar. She considered herself, of course, as the owner's wife of the mines in Ashington. And she was a very nice lady that I have on the wall behind me. A picture of Baden Powell. She presented me with that, which she bought at one of the bazaars when she was out at Ashendon, and she said, "Oh, that will have to be given to Mr. Dorgan."
So even during the strike, there was a fair relationship with...
Oh, good relationship, yes. But of course, that didn't stop any little troubles we had, because, as I said, I was in five different strikes until I started to, in my work underground, because, remember, I started as a boy of 14, as a trapper boy, and when I finished work in the Ashendon collieries, I was the four overman in 1939. In 1939, I was the four overman of the same pit that I had started when I was 14 years of age.
What were the other two strikes that you remember?
Oh, I forget. No. I forget them, sorry.
No problem. We've discussed the strikes. We were actually talking about the pit ponies. Now, we were looking at how they were looked after, and I was asking whether they ever got out of the mines for any exercise or anything like that. Did they ever get out of the mine, or did they live most of their lives down
yes,
there?
Yes, when you asked that question, I was just about to say, well, the only time they ever got out was when the pit closed down. If the pit closed down because of a strike, if a strike lasted many weeks, of course, every time there was a strike, no one knew how long the strike would last. But if it was going into many weeks, the ponies were bought out and they were put into the fields owned by the coal company, because the whole of Ashendon area, all the land and farms and so on for miles and miles around, belonged to the coal company. Ashendon Collieries was a tremendous big enterprise. They owned many hundreds and hundreds of acres of land.
So the ponies would live... When would they be taken down the pit? They wouldn't be born down the pit, would they?
No, they had to be... I'm not too sure about it, but there had to be a certain age before they could go down the pit. A couple of years, you know. A pony, of course, it develops quickly, you know. And a pony looks fully grown, even only 2 years old. The ponies were fit and strong enough to go down the pit at 2 years old, 2.5 years old. Some of them lived... Well, we had ponies who lived 15 years altogether, 15,
so
16 years.
The pony
old.
Would be down the pit from the age of 2 to the age of 15 without coming out again. It would stay down.
Oh, yes, they did, yes. Some ponies would never be out at all, no.
Did that not lead them to them being a little unhealthy without any...
No, I can only speak of the ponies at Ashendon Colliery. And... The stables in Ashendon Colliery, each one had his own little, stall, his own stall with its manger at the top end, with its straw. They were dieted well, and they were periodically examined to see they were fitting well. And if a putter or a driver ill-used his pony, he was very severely dealt with by the manager of that particular pit. The only way he could punish them, of course, by fining them. But they seemed to have the mine manager seemed to have the power, and they did find a boy or a man who misbehaved down the pit. It was easy for them because they were the paymasters, and all they needed to do was to keep the money back. and a minor could appeal to his union if he thought he was being badly used. But generally, there was a good relationship from that point of view.
So the ponies were fairly healthy. What did they actually
very,
eat?
Oh, very well, yes.
What did they eat?
Eat? Well, they got corn, as far as my memory goes, corn and hay. That's staple food. And I understand they were dressed. They were given some medical stimulant every now and then, after so many weeks.
Who was in charge of clearing out the stables, you know, keeping them clean?
Horsekeepers. Depend on the number of horses, depend on the number of ponies, rather, because there was no horses down the pit, they were all ponies. Shetland ponies, mostly, and they were very short in stature, but very, very strong and well-built. Well fed with the hay and the corn. The manger in the stall, one section held sort of a box where the grain was, and then the other two-thirds of the manger was the hay. So always seemed to have ample food, and all the ponies to me seemed to be very well fed and very good condition.
So the pony keepers would look after the pony. You wouldn't.
The horsekeeper, yes. So it was men whose horsekeeper had been working with horses all their lives.
But you putters wouldn't have to do anything on that
side. We collected our pony at the beginning of the shift, put it, and the harness would be hung up at the side of the stall, and we would yoke, as we called it, the pony ourselves, put the harness on, put his head gear on, and...
What was the headgear?
Headgear was, you know, a mouthpiece. I always had a... At first, the oldest way to put the... A mouthpiece was a metal... Two pieces of metal joined together loosely, and then the harness goes over the head. And I always thought you had to be very careful, but you soon got used to putting the head gear onto the horse's head and the rest of the gear, and you took them out, did your day's work, brought them back, took off his harness. He always took off his harness and headgear, hung them up in the stall, and you were finished. The horsekeeper looked after the ponies. But before that, attached to every stable was the horse pond. There was a special entrance. There was one way into the stables and one way out. The way in, you went in, walk in, dry. But when you finished your day's work, each pony had to be put through the wash pond. This was about 60 or 80 yards in length and full of water up to a height of about 2'6", 2'9". And alongside of it was a road walk, and the driver or the pony driver would walk alongside along the wash pond with his particular pony, making sure the pony didn't stay in the wash pond. In any case, the driver or pony pony driver, he was responsible for taking them through the wash pond and into the stables and taking off his harness, hanging it up, and you always had to put the stall headgear on, which fastened around the pony's neck, just a sort of a neck strap, so that the pony was confined to that particular stall and couldn't get out.
Would the ponies be very tired when they finished a day's work? No.
Never seemed to. No. I never gave it a thought. I mean, they all seemed so strong, these Shetland ponies. Strong, very, very well built. Very short in stature, of course. We were not allowed, for instance, you see, the working place from the shaft could be a matter of 2 miles, 2.5 miles, 3 miles away in, if the pit was an old pit, had been working some years, as all the Ashenden pits had been working many, many years. And we pony drivers used to lie on the back of your pony and ride the pony into a working place instead of walking. You're not allowed to do that. And the overman and I myself, many years afterwards, towards the end of my time at work in the pit, with my yardstick, because every official down the pit carries a stick 3 feet long, which is called a yardstick. It's used as a measuring rod. It's used, of course, by the man that has the stick to help him in walking underground. I remember when I was a driver boy and a putter lad, Rowley Conway, one of the overmen, he used to chalk, just ordinary chalk, his stick. And he would stand in the dark somewhere on the roadway, and we driver boys would be lying flat on the back of the pony, with the pony riding us in to work, and instead of, you were not allowed to do that, instead of leading your pony in to its working place. And as he went past, he would use his stick to hit you on the back, which he had chalked, so that you couldn't deny being the one who he had challenged in riding a pony, because there was the chalk mark. And the chalk mark is a bit difficult to get off your back, off your coat, and I remember I was often fined 2 bob. That seemed to be Rowley Conway, the overman's.
Why weren't you allowed to ride the pony in?
Well, a pony was, because a pony had work to do, and not, he wasn't there to carry you. That's simply that. To me, it didn't make any difference to the pony. I used to think myself, well, the pony had to go in there, and you had a close affection with your pony, and you lay on the top of the horse of the pony's back with your arms around his neck, you know, and there you just went in sailing in there, and the pony wasn't there, but for your convenience.
Did you get more pay now you were an adult, because you were over 20 now?
Yes, it was a known fact in the Northumberland coalfields, I can only speak of the coalfields I know of, that when a putter became 21, he was entitled to more money. First of all, he got a shilling a day more than the rest of the putters, and a shilling a day, of course, was a lot of money, 7 shillings a week extra money. But in addition to that, every putter lad was on piecework, and you counted by the score, your terms that you took in. And every putter lad had a token, a tin token with a number on it, piece of twine, which when you took your empty tub in to the workman who filled the tub, you fastened the string on the inside of the tub, and then there was a little hole, only the size of a penny, and the token was your own number hung outside. So that when that particular tub reached the surface, the Czech weighman could read off to the man through the office on the weighbridge your particular number, and you're credited in his book with having put that tub in to the workman. The workman also, when he filled a tub, he also had a token. His token would be perhaps a bit stronger, if I remember. Mine, the putter lad, was only of tin. His was of a stronger material, and it had a different number altogether. And so that when the tub reached, when the full tub reached the surface, and it was being weighed on the weighbridge on the surface, the boy would call out the two numbers, the putter's number and the workman's number who had filled it. And so you were credited with that particular tub.
How would you know where to go to pick up a full tub? How would you know where to go each time? Did you have a particular coal hewer you went to?
Well, you see, yes, why not? On every landing or siding, where the pony driver, not the putter, the driver brought the empty tubs in from the endless rope haulage circulation, you took up your tubs from them. Sometimes, if it is a particular bad working place, the putter could only take two empty tubs in, sometimes three, sometimes four, never any more than four, and he would take those in to the next siding or landing from which he would take each tub, empty tub, in to the work who filled the tub. Now, he would ask the workman how long would he have, and he would look himself to see how much loose coal the workman had, and he would estimate how long